Welcome to Women and Shakespeare. I'm your host, Dr. Varsha Panjwani, and today I want you to think about what community means to you. For an earlier generation, it was something, perhaps, that they belonged to through accident of birth and place. But in a world where we choose our own communities, it has come to signal differently. I asked a lot of people what belonging to a community meant to them, and they mentioned friendship, shared goals, joint ownership of ideas and values, activism. They described communities as nerve centers. It was about showing up for each other. Acceptance, something that keeps you connected to the world around you or keeps you connected to yourself. These communities that they were describing were sometimes in person, sometimes online. Sometimes they were very diverse, sometimes not so much. Maybe something of long standing, something of a very short duration, like the people who would clap with you and the people who would kneel by your side. In global lockdown, we have realized how much of our well-being is related to our sense of belonging to these communities. A theater that brings together different communities in a shared experience is therefore precious. If communities need their theatres, then in the post-COVID-19 world, it is the theatres that need their communities. So please spare a thought for the community theatres and the struggles that they are facing at this time. Do anything you can to help keep them alive. With this plea in mind, I'm thrilled to introduce this month's guest, Chris Bush. She has won multiple awards for her plays, which range from the latest hit, Faustus, to small and large-scale musicals. But before you start getting any stereotypical ideas, her musicals are delightfully political pieces, such as Tony Blair the Musical and The Assassination of Katie Hopkins. In this episode, however, we will be talking about her large-scale community theatre adaptations of Shakespeare's plays. The episode was recorded in my classroom, and at various points you will witness the spontaneous burst of enthusiasm from my students, despite the fact that they were trying to be very quiet for this recording. You're very welcome here, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
When did you first encounter Shakespeare, and what was the nature of that encounter?
I think probably it was A Midsummer Night's Dream, and it would have been at the Crucible in Sheffield, where I grew up. If I remember correctly, there was a small-scale studio, sort of really stripped-back Midsummer Night's Dream, which was just genuinely very funny and very silly and very accessible.
And so, from your introduction to Midsummer Night's Dream at the Crucible, you returned to your own Midsummer Night's Dream at the Crucible. I think that's so, so lovely. Tell us a little bit more about your phenomenal A Midsummer Night's Dream for the Sheffield People's Theatre. That's a different arm.
Yeah, so the Sheffield People's Theatre are the community, non-professional arm of Sheffield Theatres, which operate the Crucible and the Lyceum and the Studio and are the biggest producer of theatre in the UK outside of London. They've really been leading the way nationally in terms of large-scale community engagement for a number of years now. It's a very sort of open audition process, and they do these large-scale shows every year on the main stage at the Crucible, which seats give or take 1,000 people, where they will work with a company of non-professional actors drawn locally from anywhere between 75 to about 150 people, depending on the scale of the show.
So how many actors did your show have, roughly?
In Dream, I think that was slightly... So it was the second one that I did. And the Sheffield Mistress, I know, had 91. And I think this was slightly smaller. I think this was about 83, something like that.
Oh, slightly smaller. Just 83.
A mere 83. And it was always one of my big insistences that everyone has a moment where if they weren't there, they'd be missed. And that felt integral to the nature of this show.
Yeah, so at least 83 yes. Individual moments. Not a challenge at all. I want to go back to the very first time that you gave a lecture to my students, and you opened by saying, and I'm going to quote you here, you said, "If you ever find yourself in the position of rewriting a Shakespeare text, the first question you might legitimately ask yourself is, why?" So I am legitimately asking you, why Shakespeare?
I think it's a two-part question in that why would you choose Shakespeare above all the other pieces in the world, including new pieces that you might write? And then the second part being, well, if you are choosing Shakespeare, why aren't you just doing the Shakespeare as written and leaving it alone? Mm. why Shakespeare in a community setting, I think there's something really interesting about sort of the agency going on and who we entrust with cultural heritage. And rightly or wrongly, Shakespeare is seen as very much at the sort of top of that pyramid. He is still exalted as being, you know, the finest writer of the English language, certainly in theatre, and it's what we all aspire to. And because of that, I think it can be seen as something that's quite elitist and quite inaccessible and should only be done by the likes of Sir Ian McKellen, Dame Judi Dench, etc., etc. And like, great that they do it. But also, when you take that work and you put it into a community context, I think a lot of it is about demystifying it and about saying, no, actually, this is as much for you as it is for anybody else. So you hand over a building, you hand over these classic canonical works, and it's about democratizing Shakespeare through that theater, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then I think the second part as to why you would then muck around with it is to do with the logistics of what that project wants to serve. So certainly with something like Dream, and we don't really have a protagonist, you already have a handful of great parts. You have your various pairs of lovers, and you have your mechanicals, and you have whatever. So you've got easily a dozen or so good meaty parts. But if you then want to do something that can engage 80 people rather than 12 speaking and then a whole bunch of spear carriers, then you need to start thinking more cleverly about how can you rework a text so that it can feel, again, democratically spread amongst a company. How can you demystify some of the language potentially? Where relevant, how can you make it feel specifically speaking to a certain time and place?
Great. I actually want to pick up on some of the things that you said. One is very much who is trusted with Shakespeare and who can own Shakespeare. And that brings in the question of language. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we tend to be precious about Shakespeare's language in this country and sometimes fetishize it as well. And at other times, it is argued that it is difficult and it puts people off, and especially people who don't have access to libraries and teachers of Shakespeare. But then if we, say, modernize or simplify the language mm-hmm. of Shakespeare, are we actually saying that these community theater people are not able to articulate Shakespeare? So you see the double bind there. Should we make it more accessible? But in doing so, are we actually saying that these actors cannot speak Shakespeare and that is why we're modernizing it?
I don't think that it's about saying that they can't, but I think it's about going, what's the most effective way to tell this story? And also, I don't think you can set rules about when doing a community adaptation, you should approach your text in such and such a way, because obviously all communities are totally different and you will work with community companies who might have been making work for years and years and years and have a real rich understanding, as do the expected audience who might come along to support them. And therefore you could go, actually, the even the most knotty and complex bits of language would be fine. You might be working with a company who have legitimately never set foot in a theatre before, and equally most of the expected audience might be first-time theatre goers, and that's not to speak down to them, but I think that then makes logistical choices about how you might approach language differently. Also, I think there's a sort of reverence that we treat Shakespeare with, which actually isn't helpful. I think I approach Shakespeare or any kind of classic text with a great deal of love and a great deal of irreverence. And I think that's the sort of most useful way for me anyway to start tackling it. Because, you know, as a relatively educated woman who sort of knows a little bit about such things, I can go and see a Shakespeare at the Globe or at the RSC or at the National or whatever being done by the finest actors in this country. And I, maybe even with texts that I've read before, and huge chunks of language will still totally wash over me, or I get the rough gist, but I switched off because it came like a wall of text. If I'm finding that in like huge professional productions, I mean, maybe that's just my attention span. Maybe that's my fault and I should try harder, but I don't think it is just me.
And thank you for reminding us both that we might not acknowledge, but we also struggle with Shakespeare's language, and also that there are many types of community theatres. Some, as you said, would be dealing with these classic texts for a while, and some not. But I want to come back to one of the other things you said, that you wanted to have a classic text like Shakespeare, but you also wanted it to be Sheffield. people's story. And I think you did it really beautifully with the setting of your reworking, because you put it in, I believe, a teaching hospital in Sheffield.
Yes. Felt like a really useful setting, because sort of illness can be this great leveler that actually a large hospital is a space where absolutely anyone from any walk of life could legitimately turn up, where you can have kings and peasants in theory in the same accident emergency ward. Northern General is the name of a teaching hospital in Sheffield, which sits up on a hill. It's absolutely massive. And I would say that almost everyone in the city, of 500,000 people, give or take, will have had some interaction with that place at some point or the other. You might have been born there. You might have been treated there. You might have visited a friend there. So it has a sort of landmark status within the city that's quite useful. And then specifically in terms of a dream, so it seemed like a really nice way of justifying magic. Love potion was this idea that anyone up on the right sort of dose of morphine could fall in love with the first person to walk through the door. And so this became our structural intervention. So yeah, our love potion essentially became very potent painkillers. And then we had Oberon and Titania became Dr. O'Brien and Tatiana, who was a head of surgery, a head of medicine, who are both competing over the best and brightest new Indian medical student who has arrived to train there, who they both want to recruit to their specialism. And just this anyway, sort of anybody could sort of walk through the doors at any given time, felt like a useful place to exist in.
So both contributing to the world of the play and the world of the players as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Could I ask you a little bit more about the fact that you imported a lot of characters from other Shakespeare's plays as well?
Yeah. So this was like another both fun and sacrilegious big intervention that we made, was that we used Midsummer Night's Dream as the overarching structure of the play, but then we would continually cut to mostly standalone scenes in different rooms, different wards, different parts of the hospital, which would be populated by as many different Shakespearean lovers from different plays as we could fit in. So we had a sort of Romeo and Juliet being rushed in, having taken an overdose and actually sort of having a happy ending in this version. We had a Antony and Cleopatra, who were elderly couple now on their respective fifth and third marriages, who had met on a Nile cruise and were enjoying their golden years together. We sort of looked at familial love, as well as Prospero and Miranda moment, where Prospero is old and frail and is being taken home and knows that he sort of doesn't have all that long left. And it was a way of peppering in all these little cameos as a very practical way to give these people better parts, but also, I guess, as a way to draw a thread between all these different, essentially, love stories.
So it's a very practical solution, but it also tells us, okay, what might be the difference between, say, Antony and Cleopatra and Romeo and Juliet as well. But who do you expect the audience for these shows is? Would they be familiar enough with all the plays of Shakespeare to enjoy playing? Let's see which character this corresponds to.
I wanted them to feel almost a bit like Easter eggs, in that if you came in with no prior knowledge at all, there might be bits that were a bit confusing and might be the odd moment where you go, I don't really know why we've had this scene for the last 5 minutes and now we're back in something I can follow. But more or less you would, you know, hopefully if the standard of writing and everything else stands up, then they're enjoyable moments in and of themselves. And then if you have a sort of little bit of knowledge, then you might pick up on a few. And if you're Shakespeare expert, you might see a few more. But again, because I was expecting my audience to be, for the most part, quite a lot of first-time theatre goers, not necessarily with a huge amount of Shakespearean knowledge, we stuck to the better-known ones in that scenario as well. So we were looking at, so starting with Dream, Romeo and Juliet, a sort of enough of Antony and Cleopatra that you only really need to know the names Antony and Cleopatra, a bit of Rosalind in the Forest, a little bit of
Beatrice and
Benedict,
my favorites.
But not doing a Coriolanus, not doing a Timon of Athens, not doing a Merry Wives of Windsor or anything that felt a little bit obscure, really, which was a a deliberate choice, not just a gap in my scholarship.
I want to talk about the lyricism. You said that you wanted to imbue it with a different sort of lyricism, and I think you really did, but tell us a little bit more about it.
We made the choice that for the most part we weren't going to use verse, we were going to use relatively contemporary naturalistic dialogue, mostly in a Sheffield dialect, which was again to do with that idea of ownership and something that felt right in the mouths of the people who were going to be saying it. But then again, we wanted to use verse significantly to the point of which people slipped into traditional iambic pentameter was very clearly when they were under the influence of the love potion, so that suddenly the lights would go pink and they would go into this very slightly pat, slightly chad, dum-dum-dum-dum way of expressing love in a way that felt like a very distinct mode and a choice of going, oh, now I understand that I'm in like the language of love and the language of sort of declarative expressions. But then also of trying to draw those lines between the original text and what I was doing with it. Yes, in fact, I'll do a little quote from it. So, as we will all know, in the end of Shakespeare's Dream, we get Puck's speech addressing the audience and apologising and going, if we shadows have offended, think but this and all is mended that you have but slumbered here while these visions did appear and this weak and idle theme no more yielding but a dream. And in our version, Puck is this impish pharmacologist who has been responsible for spreading a lot of this sort of mischief. And we have a kind of reveal at the end, spoilers, that perhaps everything that we've witnessed over the last 2 hours, which has gone fully sort of magical realism at this point and has got quite strange and surreal, has only existed in the minds of Hippolyta, who has fallen asleep in A&E while waiting to be seen, having injured herself. And so everything has just been sort of imagined around her. So again, our Puck addresses the audience at the final moments of the show, acknowledging this it was all a dream trope, and says, if this reveal offends or cheating seems, to wake and find the whole night was a dream and all that came before was make-believe, it never was our purpose to deceive. But as anyone will tell you, in our trade, each one of us from all our dreams is made, all that we are and all we yearn to be always begins in slumbering fantasy. In sleep we light the sparkles, stoke the fires that help us chase our waking heart's desires. And so inspired by our nocturnal flight, we do by day those things we dreamt by night. So now as we release you to your beds with tales of love and longing in your heads, I wish you well, and on our evening's theme, good night, my friends, and sleep perchance to dream.
I really love how you're playing with Shakespeare's language by using it, but also slightly mocking it as well. So now I want to ask you about something that bothers me about Midsummer Night's Dream a lot. And what I get really unsettled by, to see Titania being manipulated into intimacy with an ass-headed bottom by Oberon. To me, this moment in A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is not talked about that much, seems like taming of the shrew at a celestial level. Did it bother you? Did you skirt around it? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes beyond that moment, in that the structural engine of Midsummer Night's Dream revolves around people being in non-consensual relationships, essentially, until they gradually figure themselves out by the end of it. Which does feel like something that needs our attention and our concern. I think, so it's about the level of agency that Titania has actually feels like the crucial thing, because I think that there are ways of playing it, which is clearly not the intent of the original, so you are going against it, where actually you can play the potion as the excuse, and actually you can play a fully compos mentis Titania who is frustrated with her on and off lover Oberon, and actually quite fancies the idea of, oh yeah, no, I'm definitely under the influence of a love potion. Oh, I've got to go and like shag this hunky donkey man, you know, which depending on how you set that up and how you play it, you know, can be a more appealing choice from her end than others. We did something slightly different in our version, in that it was very clear that this was never a consummated relationship, and it was no more, yeah, so a lot of the jeopardy was was removed, which is, I think, something that I massively struggle with in a lot of both for Shakespearean comedies and tragedies of sort of, yeah, plot that revolves around manipulative sex.
I think, again, yeah, so it bothers me that it is approached uncritically so many times. So, but yes, thank you for outlining the various ways around it as well. I want to now turn to your other Shakespeare that you reworked for the National Theatre's Community Theatre Arm. And wait for it, it was Pericles.
Yes.
So, why Pericles?
So I broke all my rules about accessible Shakespeare in a community setting.
I mean, we went round the houses a little bit. And actually, rather than doing something very well known, we landed on Pericles. In a way, its obscurity then became a useful excuse for the level of textual intervention that it required, because actually it's not so beloved, it's not so well known, it is a bit of a mess of a text. So it's got to like the last, basically, you only really do Pericles for the final scene, because it's got a great reunion scene, which is yes. arguably one of the best things that he ever wrote, and it's beautiful, and there's a lot of nonsense that comes before that. It's quite fun nonsense, but again, it's a lot of nonsense.
I love it for its hopping around the whole world.
Yes, and this is another of the great reasons. So why it worked for us is, yes, so basically, for those of you who are less familiar with Pericles, it is a series of inexplicable shipwrecks, and this is the entire plot of Pericles. It keeps on getting shipwrecked and washed from sort of one city to the other. But basically, he has to leave his home because he is being pursued by a murderous king, and travels around various different islands or in and around the Mediterranean, which basically means there are four or five, maybe, very distinct worlds, which is great when you're just trying to do huge numbers stuff, because every time you turn up in a new place, you can experience an entirely different community. And our Pericles very much became a story of home and what home means, and this idea of home being not a physical place but the people who surround you. So we had this dialogue in the end about being home is not the country of your birth or the house you grew up in. Home is the one who leaves the light on and won't sleep until they hear the door click, which very much felt like it was the right story for to do with a huge community ensemble. So we had eight different partner organizations from around London targeting marginalized and unrepresented groups who really had very, very little experience in the whole of theatre in general. We had groups who worked with people who'd experienced homelessness. We had elderly people at risk of isolation. We had young carers. We had a real, very, very diverse, very sort of representing London at a whole, and the kind of London that we don't always see. And to tell a story about home and acknowledge that home is something that's quite difficult for a lot of people, that isn't always neat and tidy, that does also involve loss and does involve pain, felt like a really powerful thing. And again, we had this this refrain that became the lyric in the final song, which was this idea, I am my own way home. And we had a moment at the end of the show, large group of members of the company would come through and speak this phrase, I am my own way home, in their own native languages. And over the course of the company of in excess of 200 people, we must have had dozens and dozens, probably at least, I would say, 50 different languages spoke within that. So what sort of starts off one by one and then builds up and becomes a sort of wall of sound, and felt like a real statement of intent, of ownership, of what the National Theatre is for, what that project was for, what in its best days, and God, it doesn't feel like it now, but what it feels like the country could be for, of like coming together and in a sense of belonging.
I love it because, again, like Sheffield, this was so much about the play. It is enriching the play itself because, of course, Pericles goes around and learns from these different communities. But it is also, in a sense, so much about London, where we have such a shifting population and so many languages being spoken as well. When you do these, do you sit with the text? Or once you've read it, you forget it and come back to it?
I feel like I probably sit with it to begin with and then put it aside and then do most of my drafting. And then, I mean, it was going to, because they were different, because Dream was very much, was a bigger intervention in that all the language was new and we had all these other characters. Whereas Pericles was more rooted in the original text, there was a sort of, there was a lot of haggling that kind of went on with the National Theatre in a very, you know, in an absolutely fine way, but of sort of going, how much of the Shakespeare in terms of the actual language, the actual words, do I need to use? Or where you start to repurpose the language in a slightly more piecemeal ways. There's a moment where Pericles has to leave his baby Marina behind for not at all justified reasons in the original. Again, it needs some work on his motivation. But he leaves her behind, and we had this moment where he sort of sings her a lullaby before he goes, which started with, "Hush now, my Marina, my mistress, no tears. A terrible childbed hast thou had, my dear. A blusterous birth under sulphurous skies, rumbled a thunderous lullaby." And it becomes this lovely lullaby. And all those individual snippets of phrases of language, so "hush now, my Marina, and my mistress, no tears, terrible childbed, blusterous birth, sulphurous skies," these are all phrases that exist with mostly within, I think, that exact scene when he's talking to a nurse and saying, "You take her now and leave her behind." But was a way of pulling all those things together and going, okay, I can take the most beautiful phrases from this and try and get them into a lyric, which felt like another way of serving the language.
So do you think that music and songs work naturally with Shakespeare?
I think so. I mean, I'm just sort of all for putting songs in anything, to be fair. Especially...
I'm with you. Working on Bollywood and Shakespeare, I'm totally with you on that.
Why not get in a dance routine? We had cheerleaders, we had a scar band of pirates, we had all sorts in Pericles. It was great. I mean, for a start, the music is all about emotional connections, that you can do so much more with, you know, four bars of music to convey emotion than you can in a whole soliloquy. Obviously, you've got a verse structure there already, so that can really lend itself to the music. And again, I think it just gives you another texture.
Great. And so with everything that you've talked about, I keep coming back to this really compelling essay, and it's by Professor Douglas Lanier, Shakespearean Rhizomatics, Adaptations, Ethics and Value. And he argues very strongly against this hierarchy that privileges Shakespeare's original text, whatever original might mean, above the adaptations.
I think, for me, the critical thing is just that there's space for all of it, actually. So it's not about saying every Shakespeare needs to be fundamentally rewritten in order to make it accessible for a new audience. I don't think that's the case. There is value in doing doublet and hose and codpiece Shakespeare that says all the words in the right order, if that's your bag. It's just about saying that's not the right way to do it. That's just a way to do it, as is the version that turns it on its head and does something very different in terms of its approach to the language, but also in terms of its approach to its politics, its characterization, its setting, or anything else.
So what you're saying is that there's space for all of it, but definitely the hierarchy needs to be reevaluated.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Thank you so much.
At all.
That was Chris Bush talking about A Midsummer Night's Dream, Pericles, and about democratizing Shakespeare and the pleasures of sharing cultural heritages through community theatre. Next month, we have a real treat for you, a guest who has been one of the key figures in bringing practitioners and academics into closer contact in the UK. We are really excited that she is the brand new Vice President of the Shakespeare Association of America. She is...
Hello, this is Farah Karim Cooper, and you're listening to Women and Shakespeare.
So, dear listeners, adieu, adieu, adieu. Remember to tune in to Women and Shakespeare, streaming at Apple and Spotify. If you want to listen to the podcast with full transcripts, head over to our website, www.womenandshakespeare.com. Until then, keep shattering those glass ceilings.